This is episode 22 of the Software Freedom Law Show for March 2nd, 2010.
The one, the only, Mike Tarantino live on the Software Freedom Law Show.
Hello, I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And I'm Karen Sandler.
And this is the Software Freedom Law Show.
We started a little differently, perhaps, than previous shows because we're in a different location this time.
Well, we're in an extremely temporary location, I think.
To me, this location is not temporary.
But it's a temporary recording facility.
That's true. We are actually in my apartment. At the time that we're recording this, New York City has gotten a lot of snow.
That's true.
It is a lot easier for us to get together to record this at my apartment than it is for us to meet at the Software Freedom Law Center.
Yeah, they have subway delays.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Yeah. So. And it's just really, really nasty out. So thank you for coming to me.
Oh, it's not that. It's not that big of a deal. I mean, there's people that have 3 and 4 feet of snow regularly in the United States.
That's true.
It's pretty common in some places. So
and
I don't
in
see
some
why
places,
freak
it's,
out so much.
It's really uncommon. Well, yeah, it's not even that uncommon in New York. We get a lot of snow here. Yeah. Every winter, we have at least a few major snowstorms. And the reason why we started with our unusual beginning was in part because we have access to our very own musician, Mike Tarantino, who is on his way out the door.
So... we're actually repeating the history of Linux Outlaws with the electric then acoustic theme song later.
Oh, I didn't know that.
See, you don't know your Linux Outlaws history.
I don't.
Fab, she doesn't know. You're going to have to email her an entire historical accounting.
You don't have to email me an entire historical accounting.
Well, don't you want to know? See, if you knew the Linux Outlaws history, you would know. I've listened to Linux Outlaws since episode like 8 or something. Or
That's
12.
Great. Yeah. I
was scared of Fab.
Were you? Why?
His voice is scary. When his accent was stronger, he was scary. His voice sounded scarier. Because it was also called Outlaws, and so I fell for the same usual thing. Like, I thought they were going to talk about breaking into computers and stuff. I really did.
I thought you were saying something strange about German people.
No, I thought he was some German outlaw, specifically.
Oh.
Well, with a heavy accent. Anytime somebody has a heavy accent of any kind, it doesn't matter what their native language is.
See,
and
that's
then
funny
they're
because...
identified as an outlaw. I mean, this is what they do on TV. They put people with any random accent and then make them an outlaw on US TV. It happens all the time. It used to happen all the time when we were kids.
Yeah, we have a strange culture.
Yeah.
Where we're afraid of...
of people with accents, basically.
Of people with accents. It's pretty silly.
Yeah, anybody who's not from... who doesn't have a standard US English accent.
Yeah, except for English accents, which we seem to adore.
And also, they were identified as outlaws. I mean, in this case, it wasn't even like you had to use external cues. The show was called Linux Outlaws. And so I thought...
But you didn't really think they were outlaws. Well, actual outlaws.
To be completely...
Which law were they out from?
To completely honest, the first time I listened to their show, I thought their show was some sort of computer cracking show. I really did. I really thought that the first time I listened to it. And then I heard that we were just talking about regular... Linuxy, free software-y things, and I was like, oh, well, that's not what they really are. That's weird. And then I kept listening. It was fine. But that's what I expect. When I saw a show called Linux Outlaws, that's what I thought. So.
That's interesting. I think I was interested.
Well, and also the Chaos Computer Club was originally based in Germany, too. So there's this connection to Germany about cracking and so forth and breaking into computers. So I think the Chaos... Well, if I'm wrong about that, somebody can write in and yell at me, but I think Chaos started in Germany, as I recall. And then, of course, spread around the world, but I have this vague memory.
Oh, and thanks to everyone who wrote in after the medical devices podcast that we did last time.
That was more feedback than we've ever gotten for any other show.
Yeah, and it was really, really helpful, so we really appreciate it.
I'm pulling up the Wikipedia entry on the Chaos Computer Club just to find out if I'm right. And I think I'm correct from my looking at this. So, yes, was founded in Berlin, September 12th, 1981. So I was correct. And so hearing a guy with a German accent on a show called Outlaws, knowing the Chaos Computer Club, came from where I know that I don't think Fab is from Berlin, but that made me think, hey, That's what it was. So
that was a really long time ago.
What's that? The Chaos Computer Club? Yes.
You said 81, right?
Yeah, that's when that was founded. Linux All Those was founded in 2007 or 6 or something.
But I'm not going to speculate about Fab's age, but I think he's
too young. Fab's a young man.
I was going to say too young for...
Fab could be born in 1981, actually.
That's what I was saying.
That could be the year of Fab's birth. But what if Fab was born the same day of the founding?
Okay.
Fab is it would be cool if Fab's birthday was September 12th, 1981.
Fab, I really like you too, but we should move on to our actual...
We have a heavy crossover listener base, though. You have to admit.
Yes, no, that's true. And it's nice.
Yeah. And he'll get all excited we're talking about
this. All right. Well, carry on then. I'll sit back on my couch.
Okay. Fab, what else do you want? He should have emailed in ahead of time about more things we wanted to say about
him. It's kind of like you tuning into the Linux Outlaws stream and hearing your name.
Yeah, but we don't have a live stream, so Fab.
No, if we only had a live stream.
You said you didn't want a live stream.
I don't want a live stream.
Then why are you saying
We've already re-recorded that little introduction thing twice.
Yeah, we didn't re-record this twice, though.
No, not this.
That's pretty obvious from this whole searching on Wikipedia for the Chaos Computer Club entry.
But you know it's pretty sad if you have to re-record this is episode 2-2.
Yeah, but you don't have to tell people we re-recorded that.
Well, I did already, and I didn't want people to think
that. So you want to re-record this so you don't have to tell people?
No, it's all fine. And now we have silence.
Well, do you know that show, that book? It's not a book, it's a short story. About the guy with the collected silences. See, I'm not usually... The other problem with this is I'm not this close to my keyboard when we record, because at my desk, when we record in the office, I move my keyboard far over, so I can't actually look things up on the internet while we're recording.
Right.
But see, I have such a temptation now.
This is kind of the coziest podcast recording we've
had yet. Yeah, I found the name of this. I read this short story when I was in an undergraduate. It's called Mirkus Collected Silences. It's actually a story originally written in German, which is a connection to Fab again. but it was a really good story. It was about this guy who was an audio engineer and he becomes obsessed with collecting people's silences because he takes the little cuts of tape where they were silent and starts looking at how silences sound different because of various
That's
different
interesting.
Things.
Interesting. I mean, there's that work. Now I want to look on the online.
Yeah, Hendrik Boll was the author of that short story. He wrote it in 1955. Here's his Wikipedia entry. Wow. So this is why, by the way, when we originally record, I let my screen. Somebody sent me recently the advice on how to keep my screensaver kicking in, which I know how to do, but. This is a good reason not to just let my screensaver kick in when we're recording the show, because here I am looking up random stuff, and basically I'm just giving... This is basically a random things you can find on Wikipedia.
By Don't bother of me, I'm online.
What's that from?
No, I'm. It's not a reference, I'm just saying, don't bother me, I'm looking on the internet.
Okay. We should actually have a show.
There's a symphony, I think it's... There's a symphony that's silence. I can't remember. That's anyway. So.
That's sort of like the same Beckett play that opens with the curtain opens and all you hear is.
Yeah.
And that's the
is
entire
that play?
Play? It's a play.
I think it's called. He has a play called Play.
Yeah, yeah. But, that, but that, there's a play where they open the curtain and he just. Somebody exhales or inhales, actually, and then it's over.
Breathing is, I think, a key component to that. Anyway, let's not talk about Beckett. I was going to say about the weather that it's a big change from where we were last weekend, because both of us were at Scale last weekend, the Southern California Linux Expo.
You're actually trying to connect this up to what we're going to talk about.
I am trying to connect it up.
That's true, and you gave a talk at Scale.
You also gave a talk at Scale.
That's true, but you gave a talk.
We don't usually go to the same conferences that much anymore.
Not since OSCON. Have Carrot and Bradley been at the same conference at the same time in the same location?
We were giving
in the same time space continuum.
We were. I think maybe the collaboration summit last year was more recent.
OSCON was more recent than that. That was July.
Was that the last time that we spoke together?
That's correct. Because
LinuxCon?
Because we did a show from the Linux Collaboration Summit. In my
That's
hotel room.
True.
And then we
true.
Did a show and we got back from OSCON.
This is cozier than that was.
That's true.
But LinuxCon.
Oh, that's true. And Dan was there too.
And Dan was there too.
Wow. So that was the full Software Freedom Law Show contingent.
Well, without Mike, our musician.
Yeah, but he's here this time, or was.
No, he was. He's gone now. Anyway, so at Scale, we both gave talks, and...
Well, you gave a talk that is a very important topic that we should discuss.
Yeah, it's one that we tend to not talk about that often.
Why don't we talk about it more often?
All right.
Well, I was asking why we don't.
Why don't we? You know, I think we're so focused on copyright that we tend not to think about the other... Well, that's not true, actually, because we are also very focused on patents, and we talk about software patents quite a lot. So we've basically got
There's a lot more to say about copyright. I mean, I don't know if I get in trouble for saying this, but I think software patents are bad, and that's usually just what we say is that software patents are bad. So there's not much to say about software patents, really.
Especially we do talk a lot about software patents in the context of we had a whole show about Bilski, and patents come up a lot, either because they're being asserted or we hear about patent licensing deals or cross-licensing pools. So we see it a lot. And, you know, what we're actually talking about is trademark law. And there have been scandals related to
trademark law,
too.
We're not talking about it yet. We're about to talk about it.
We're about to. I know. I thought that you're the one who usually doesn't like to do the teasers, so I thought I would just jump into it.
And you're swinging that cable and you're going to hit my screen. I'm scared.
Oh, no. I was worried that I was going to make noise with it.
I'm taking it away.
This show became a lot less cozy feeling.
Because you don't have a random extension cable to wave around? Or technically it's a splitter cable? It was just so close to my screen, it scared me.
All right. That's fine.
I'm very particular about my LCDs.
So the talk that I gave was pretty basic. It was actually entitled, What You Need to Know About Trademarks.
Well, I think a lot of projects don't generally think about the issue of trademark. They think about copyright first, of course, because that's what they generate first when they start writing software. They probably think about patents second because they hear about them so much, and we've talked about before how people should be not so terrified by patents as much as they are. I try, although recently I did, I generally try not to enter the debate about how all software patents are stupid, because there are so many stupid software patents, and it's just not worth considering the fact that any software you write is going to read on thousands of software patents no matter what you do.
The patents will read on the...
Yeah, software. The patents will read on any software you write, and you're going to have thousands of patents reading on it, and there's nothing you can do about it. So then they think, I think hackers tend to think through... First, they think about copyrights. They can do something about that. They can choose a free software license. Then they think about patents, and there's only so much they can do about that. They can license under a free software license that has some sort of patent protection, but generally speaking, they're going to have some annoyance about patents, and they can generally just ignore it. And by the time they get to thinking about trademarks, it's... They don't want to think about this stuff.
Yeah, it's just another thing to worry about. And the nice thing about trademarks is that you probably can avoid dealing with them or if you find out there's a problem. Well,
they should think about them a bit more, right?
Should be thought about.
Because what is the first thing that a free software project does, even before they start writing code?
Well, they don't always, but many times they do register their domain name.
No, or they just name the project.
And they name
they
the
call
project.
It something,
yeah.
Right? Even if it's just for the name of the repository,
right.
They have a name of some kind. And people do use code names and then change it later. Lots of people do things like that. But generally speaking, there is a name involved from the very beginning. And that's where
that's
an issue like trademark can come up, right?
That's right. And my talk was What You Need to Know About Trademarks, which was very basic. And
Can you tell us what we need to know about trademarks?
I will tell you some of what I think you need to know about trademarks just as soon as we take this brief musical interlude.
So, we have to answer this question. What do free software projects need to know about trademarks?
You know, that's interesting. It's interesting. I hope it's interesting because that's what I gave my talk about. my talk and the slides are going to be on our website. But in my talk, I wanted to describe what trademarks are and what you need to do to, or what you need to know in order to, A, look after your own mark in the interest of your free software project, and secondly, or B, I can't remember what I said. The second thing would be just to come up with a good policy and understanding what your obligations are with respect to other people's marks.
So generally, you get copyrights automatically. Do you get a trademark automatically when you start calling something something.
Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting because with copyright, you just get copyright when you fix your expression in a tangible medium is what the law says. So basically, whenever you write that code, it's the process of writing it, actually creating the code, is fixing it in the tangible medium. And as soon as it's created, you get copyright in that work. Trademark is a little different. If you create a logo or you create a name of something, you don't have anything under trademark law until you use it. So you
and
do
how,
get,
how do you have to use it? What do
okay.
you have to do?
You basically have to start calling your software or your product or, you know, whatever the situation it is that you're in, by a certain name and use a certain picture or logo in order to refer to it. And it's all about, products and packaging and brand management. So the idea is that under trademark, you create a trademark by creating labels. So by calling your software by a certain name and publishing it, you start to get a certain amount of trademark protection because you've identified who you are and what the product is by the trademark.
In the old days, they used to say you had to use it in interstate commerce in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Is that still the rule?
It is still a rule that you need to use it in commerce. And then there's common law protection state by state mm-hmm. if you use it within a state. Mm-hmm. And those rules still apply, but they're a little bit old-fashioned because we're never going to – I mean, we're in the situation where we work with developers work with each other all over the place, you know, in different countries, in different states. And as soon as you publish something, you publish it to everybody at the same time online. So it's a little bit different, and the trademark office does accept use on a web page as an example of use in interstate commerce.
Yeah, I remember when I wanted to establish I got a service mark for my personal mm-hmm. domain. I actually invoiced my father for $1, so I'd used it in interstate commerce to be able mm-hmm. to be sure I'd done so. But that, as you're saying, this sounds kind of old-fashioned. That was back in the early 90s.
You can also, in an old-fashioned way, you could have always produced a business card, mm-hmm. and you could have just had one made and sent in an example of it to the trademark office. A lot of people did that. So now they just take like screenshots of web pages and things like that. Anything that shows that you're identifying a product or a service or a business or an organization with a name and a logo or a name or a logo, I guess, you actually start to get trademark protection. And it's only by, you get certain protection just by using it alone.
So we've talked before about with copyright, you generate the copyrights and you have them. But then in the U.S., there are various benefits from registering the copyrights, which we've talked about mm-hmm. extensively on previous shows. What are the benefits of registering the trademark?
Well, there are some basic benefits to registering a trademark. The one that I think is the most obvious is that registering the trademark is effective notice. So you're presumed to be giving notice to everyone in the United States when you register a trademark that you intend to protect that mark, that you're using it in your business. And there's a presumption of notice once you've registered it. There's also a presumption of ownership. So the idea is that if somebody disputes your use of the mark and says it's their mark, it's really up to them to show that you shouldn't have had that mark and that it's theirs. So that burden goes to them.
So you use the word ownership. I'm sorry to go off on this tangent because I always hate talking about copyrights being owned because I always say copyright holder.
And it's this idea of intellectual property and the complications.
Right, and that's I try to avoid that. That's why I don't talk about ownership. I guess it bothers me less with regard to a name because I feel a certain amount of ownership of my personal name. Obviously, I don't have a service mark or a trademark mm-hmm. on my personal name, but I think that projects feel a certain amount of ownership to their names mm-hmm. in the same way like your individual name would be important to you and you feel some ownership to it. It's the same way for people who get together in groups and projects. So it actually, of all the types of ownership in copyrights, patents, trademarks, so forth, this seems the most reasonable. Is that the impetus that creates the systems?
I think it might be because actually, as you were saying that, I was thinking that it's really easy to draw the analogy from your own personal name to how the trademark laws apply generally. Mm-hmm. So for example, my name is Karen Sandler. There are a lot of other Karen Sandlers. And when my parents named me, they knew there were a lot of other Karen Sandlers. There's a romance novelist named Karen Sandler, an HIV researcher named Karen Sandler. If somebody says Karen Sandler, you might not know who who you're referring to exactly, because you would say that it maybe is a weak mark, because it's very common. The name Karen is very common, and the name Sandler is very common. And
are you saying you've been genericided, Karen?
No, I haven't been genericized, but we should get to that, because genericiding is fascinating. But I am saying that I know there's another Bradley Coon, at least.
Well, actually, there is a Brad Coon, doesn't go by Bradley like I do, who drives a certain type of race cars called midget race cars, which I don't know exactly which type they are. But
so that's a more distinctive name. And so people who name their children very unusual names know that they're creating a more unique brand for their children, and there are benefits and downsides to that.
Yeah, there's also
a
Bradley Coon killed in Arizona recently in a motorcycle accident.
Yeah, there are several Karen Sandlers right here in New York City, including another lawyer. I think she went to NYU Law School a couple of years after me. But so, you know, it's confusing. But I shouldn't be able to stop somebody else named Karen Sandler from being able to use their own name. And if somebody said, you know, the Karen Sandler who's involved in software, then you would probably know that it was me that I was referring to. So trademarks are actually tend to be limited in scope. So they're attached to fields.
Because when I was growing up in Baltimore, there was this woman named Sony, S-O-N-Y, and had a restaurant in Baltimore. And the Sony Corporation actually was in very long trademark enforcement against her. She fought it for a long period of time. I don't actually know how it came out. But this was my first introduction. As a child, this was my first introduction to trademarks. In fact, because when I went to visit the... Because if you grew up in Baltimore, you're close to D.C., so you visit the state capital often because it's an easy school trip. And they always... Your rep always tries to get floor time when they know somebody from a school from their district's in. So my... rep was speaking. She just decided to start ranting about this woman and her fight with Sony on the floor of the House, actually not the Senate, because we were there. And so I've always been interested in this issue of the scope and so forth, because it didn't seem fair to me. I don't want you to opine on that particular case, but
no,
generally speaking,
and I only know of it through you actually. But one of the basic tenets of trademark law is that it's all about whether consumers will be confused or not. So it basically, trademark is sort of in the eye of the beholder. And when you talk about trademark disputes, the question that you have to ask is there a likelihood that the consumer or the customer will be confused about the origin of the goods or the services or whatever? So the basic idea is, you know, if I were looking at that restaurant and I, you know, in Baltimore, and I didn't think, oh, that restaurant is probably owned by Sony Corporation. Maybe I'll go in there and ask about my CD player, because I guess they had CD players back then.
Yeah, it was probably... No,
I'll ask about my cassette player.
It would have been Walkman, yeah.
I'll ask about my Walkman.
It would have been the Walkman era.
Yeah, I mean, and so if she was using the Sony logo, it would be a lot clearer. You know, things that would identify it with a company. So you're basically in a situation where trademark is limited in fields, so when you want to register a trademark, you have to say what it's about. So, for example... I don't know.
I can finish the story. She gave up she didn't want to pay the legal fee. I just found it online.
It's just expensive to fight.
She didn't want to fight it, and she gave up in July 6, 1987. She gave up the fight and renamed the restaurant. So, according to this article I just found. So that's kind of an example of aggressive enforcement of trademarks, which does happen sometimes. People aggressively, and especially for a big corporation like Sony, which is in so many businesses, I guess they have trademarks filed for so many different types of endeavors, because
reasonable to expect a company that's as big as Sony to have a cafeteria somewhere or a restaurant somewhere that's connected to their store because they're so big. So, you know, I can sort of see an argument going both ways here. It's this poor woman's name, but at the same time, you know, it's a very unusual name for a person to have, and everyone's very familiar, and the public is very familiar.
Yeah, the article
I'm
reading has her name in quotes. I think that was her nickname, which was part of it too. So it says Sony, quote unquote, Florendo. So, so it's probably part of it that was her nickname too. She might have had a better shot maybe if it was her actual name rather than a nickname. It wasn't her legal name.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and you also look about, you know, you would also look at trademark is also limited to geographic use sometimes. So if you could show that she was using the term Sony in Baltimore, you know, before Sony Electronics started marketing products in that, you know, in those. That geographic area.
Probably wasn't true,
Then it probably wasn't true.
But we should send you back in time to 1986 and defend her. And then maybe you could do it pro bono, and it would change history.
I wish I had a time machine hot tub in my apartment.
So,
I haven't seen that movie, by the way, so I don't know if that's sort of an accurate
which part?
Reference to it. What?
Well, I don't know what you're referencing.
Oh, there's some movie called, that's about a hot tub that's a time machine?
No, I know the movie about the DeLorean that's a time machine. Great Scott, Marty, you know that one? That's the one I know.
I know wonder how many gigawatts it would take to run the hot tub time machine.
Well, you have to install a flux capacitor.
Yeah.
Then you need plutonium. So,
Mike might not be very happy with me.
So do you recommend that free software projects register their trademarks?
It really depends. It's not...
Because it's not cheap either, is it?
It's not crazy expensive is the thing.
It's like $500,
though, it's like $300. Roughly around there. I don't remember what the exact rate is right now, like $350. I don't remember. Mm-hmm.
Doing a logo, too, you have to pay more.
And it used to be different, I think, if you were filing in color or black and white. Mm-hmm. But it's a few hundred dollars regardless of what it is. And so it's pretty expensive. And it sort of depends how you think people are going to use the mark and whether, you know, what you want to allow them to do. When you register also, it also depends on what markets you're going to be, you know, like what countries you're going to be active in and whether you think that it's really important to prevent other people from seeming like they're you. So for a nonprofit organization, sometimes, for example, you get consulting companies who might take advantage of a confusion that they are acting on behalf of the nonprofit free software project.
Yeah, and then there's those other things too, which for example, the GNU project very much wants people to call the operating mm-hmm. system GNU/Linux. So mm-hmm. they're actually encouraging people when they include GNU software mm-hmm. to use it. Although they only want it to be used presumably when GNU software is actually included.
Yeah. There are two things. One thing is I just wanted to get back to before we moved on from the idea of what benefits you get for registering your trademark. There's also this thing called the Madrid Protocol, and that's basically a treaty that allows you to, once you register in the United States, to submit that application elsewhere in the world. So for you know, countries that have agreed to it, that's a good way of registering a trademark in more than one jurisdiction. So if you worry about that, then you do want to probably register your mark.
So should projects be, I know you probably don't want to give this advice, but do you think projects should be afraid if they haven't registered? Should they really be running out to register? Should they?
I don't think they should be afraid. I think they should think about, you know, what are they using their mark for? You know, what can the name be confused with something else? Are they paying attention to how other people may be referring to things that will sound like, that will confuse people about where it's coming from?
Thinking more from the terms of if they're worried about another project saying that they're them.
Because
it goes on both sides, right? I guess there's basically two issues that come up with names with regard to projects. You could name something that causes confusion with some other project that already exists. And that's often a problem because there's only so many good names out there that people have used up a lot of for software.
I don't think that's true. Well, okay. I don't think there are.
People tend to think that's
because
true.
Because, you know, there are different ways that you can come up with a name. And you want your name to be unique.
And an acronym.
Right.
And recursive acronym.
So for example, like open blank is like, I think to me a little bit weaker because there's so many open foo projects out there. So it sort of diminishes the uniqueness of any of those marks because everything and especially like open and then a few letters after it. I often get confused because there are so many. I have no projects particularly, so I don't get those confused. But when I hear about a new project and haven't figured out what the acronym stands for, it's sometimes tough.
I want to start a project called Open Free.
Open Free. Yeah.
Actually, I'd probably call it Free Open. Free. Can I get a trademark on that?
So I doubt it. So you can't get a trademark on things that are on words that are just sort of generic terms that don't have any color. It's very easy to get trademarks on words that are not really words or that don't, you know, that wouldn't ordinarily be seen together.
Something with no vowels, for example.
What?
Something with no vowels.
So you're going to get open freedom.
So, but I want to get back to this. There's basically these, I want to put a fine point on this, the two ways that trademark law might intercept a project. either they pick a name that somebody else already has a trademark or and or already is using in commerce, and two, once they have a name they know is unique, whether or not they should get a trademark on that name that they know is unique and they
right. Well, they do get some trademark protection. Yes, exactly. And that's it's not so too fine of a point. I mean, those are are two basic ways of looking at, you know, of how you identify yourself and how you identify the products that you use.
Right, and those are the two questions I think projects will most often run into. Is our name used by somebody else before we even started? And
actually,
do we want to protect it now that we know?
One of the situations that I see happening quite a lot is we all started this project together. Now who owns the trademark? So we get a situation a lot of times where you get projects that...
Yeah, I knew about that one. I just figured it would be too much of a can of worms.
No, I don't actually don't think it's a can of worms, but I think it's something we should talk about because, well, I mean, it is a can of worms when it actually happens, but it's very easy to avoid from the beginning. So if you're a group of people starting, you know, if you're a small group starting a free software project and you come up with a name together, think twice before you just agree. Usually one person says, okay, I'll go ahead and register the domain name for all of us, and maybe even they'll decide to register the mark, although that's less common. But you get to the situation where down the road, the person who registered the mark either is no longer involved with the active development in the free software project, or they've decided to form some consulting company or some for-profit, and they say, well, I actually registered the mark. The mark is mine, and it actually belongs to the company that I started in order to promote this free software project, not the group that we all thought of this, you know, we all started working on it together. Actually, you're misremembering, and it's very hard to show, you know, what, it's very hard to produce a record of what happened. And so one of the things I really want to press on people is that you should think about this when you first come up with a name and think about what a good way is to agreeing how the domain name will be handled in the future and how the mark will be used. Like, who has control over it and how?
I mean, that's really tough, I think, for projects to do early, because by the time they actually think about this, it's usually the project's been moving along.
Yep.
But like I said, when they create a name, they often just name the repository that and get started.
Yep.
And then a couple of months later, they register a domain and move their repository over to it. But that's usually the time when the most coding is going on, the most active work on other issues. I think projects generally have learned they have to pick a license first. And that's something that everybody's used to in the free software world. But thinking about what happens when you pick the name wrong.
Yeah, I think there's actually a need for sort of nonprofit involvement from the early stage. So saying, and, you know, I've heard others talk about this, and hopefully someone will create this and we can point to it more specifically. But I think there's a need for a nonprofit who can hold domain names in trust for a free software project.
And then they'd have to be involved in dispute resolution, presumably.
Yep.
If it came
but up. Basically, it's that same idea of decide early what will happen to the name. So just talk about it amongst yourselves. Usually it will be pretty easy because when you start out, everybody feels very equal and fair, and everybody is very optimistic about what will happen with the project. So you can say, okay, there are three of us that are working on this all the time, or two of us or whatever. The name belongs to the project, and the three of us will decide, or some group of active development, you know, the committers will decide, or by majority or whatever. But putting in something, I know it sounds very legalese, but it doesn't have to be. It can be informal, but just something in writing, something in record, something over email. If you don't have the sort of a nonprofit angle to try, then that's a good way to just have a record that you can produce that will help prevent disputes later.
Yeah, and well, the having it be held by individuals certainly is a lot better than having it being held by a company or a person's company.
And actually, sometimes that happens too, where a company volunteers to register the mark when they hear that there's an interesting project happening. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, oh, you know, our legal department will register the mark for you, don't worry. And then it's sort of you give some degree of ownership and some knowledge of the company.
I mean, a lot. Some degree.
Yeah, well, it depends on what
it depends on the agreement.
I'm such a lawyer, it depends, but you know what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, I think people should I mean, one of the things I've always advised people with free software projects is even if your project would relate to a company you're working for or with, it's better to start the project on your own time in the very beginning. This was an idea that was flying around the free software community back in the old days before there was any company really interested in free software or friendly to free software at all. And the idea was basically start on your own time at first. Make sure you're allowed to start, obviously, projects on your own time, and you don't have to sign away everything you've ever written anytime, anywhere to your company. But if you have the right to work on your own stuff on your own weekends, on your own time, on your own equipment, start projects that way. And then
sure about what's said in your employment agreements, which is also important.
Agreed.
Because there are certain circumstances where you might work on it in your own time, but you've explicitly agreed.
That's what I was saying, is make sure you haven't made such an agreement, because those agreements are evil anyway.
Yeah.
But if you do something on your own time, on your own computer.
And if you do it on your own time, but on company equipment, could also be.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Everything on your own, and
but that's gives all you, related to copyright and less.
Well, it does the name too, because if you did all the naming and started the project, they don't really have a claim to that name either, do they?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But it may seem like it's lucky that you can use the legal team at a company that you work for to take care of that for you. I would be very skeptical about that.
Oh, yeah. And I think a lot of people forget this, that even if sometimes your employer seems friendly, I know from personal experience that things can really change, and suddenly your employer is not so friendly
anymore. I mean, we have many examples of that kind of thing.
And your employer may not want you, it may try to influence things you're doing on your own time. This happens. So it's important, I think, to make sure that if you work on a project, try to do it on your own time, at least as you're getting started. And then if your company wants to fund it later.
Or if you have an explicit agreement.
But I think having control of the name among the individuals, that's a real key for making sure.
But then also figuring out how to handle that between individuals.
That's the second problem.
And then I don't know how we're doing on time, but we should talk about what projects should have for trademark policies, because I think that's sort of the other important prong.
Well, right, because there is this issue of genericide, right?
Oh, genericide. I do love talking about genericide.
So if you fail, this is the weird thing, because copyrights, people have learned that you can enforce your copyrights whenever you're ready. They generally don't expire because of Disney, which is evil in itself, but the copyrights generally don't expire because Disney keeps getting extensions.
You're sort of being facetious when you say that copyrights don't expire. They have terms, but trademarks do not. So trademarks are indefinite. All that you need to do to maintain your trademark is to continue using it and to continue to have it be identified with you. So, that's sort of a really interesting difference between trademark and copyright. Now, with software, copyrights are so long that it's almost as if they were indefinite.
The joke that I'm making, just to be clear, is that copyrights are supposed to be limited time, but they turn out not to be because Disney keeps getting extensions.
Right. Whereas trademarks are not supposed to be limited in time.
Well, so Disney must love trademarks.
Oh, Disney. Just believe me, Disney loves their trademarks. Because, there's trademark in Mickey Mouse in addition to it.
That's a complicated question, because everybody always says that the reason Disney wants extension on copyrights is because of Mickey Mouse. But yet, I've always thought this. Mickey Mouse and the ears and everything else are trademarks as well.
Will a customer be confused as to the source of the goods?
Oh, I see. So if they make a derivative work of Steamboat Willie, but then clearly say at the beginning of the film, this is not a Disney film. This is to make fun of it.
For example.
So the trademarks don't just get them enough
control. Well, if you're just making fun of a work, then you could probably have fair use exception anyway. There's no fair use. There's no actual fair use in trademark law.
Well, it's a very different situation, but there's an
analog to fair use, which is called nominative use. And that idea is that you can actually refer to the goods themselves. So if I want to, give you my can of Coke, I bought at the supermarket, I can sell it to you because it's a can of Coke and I don't have to cover up its logo or anything like that. It is factually a can of soda produced by the Coca-Cola company. And, I have every right to do that, but
I take beverages from strangers.
But if I were to set up a stand outside of my apartment building right now, it's very snowy. There are huge clumps of snow coming down. But say I thought that there'd be a great market for frosty sodas right now. If I set up a stand outside of my building and I put up the Coca-Cola sign, and then I was selling Coca-Colas, Coca-Cola products, then it would be very, you could see a customer, the public might be very confused as to who is selling that.
And places that do sell those beverages actually have licensing agreements for the trademarks to show them and show the display.
Now, if I were to sell a soda in a Coke can and maybe put something else in it, then that would be very confusing. So you sort of see, like, the different lines.
Well, this is one of the classic things that our community actually discovered early, and this is where the GNU name comes from, was that you could use the trademark, because everybody was worried in the old days about the Unix tro. You can't say something's Unix, and if you say it's Unix, you get in trouble. And Sun did the same thing with Java when Java came out. It was like, can't say this is Java or that. Or even if it's written in Java, you can't call it Java, you know, because everybody wanted to call it Java Foo. Like, they do with Open Foo these days. Everybody was writing Java Foo in the early 90s. Yeah.
Now, so there's this idea of nominative use. You can call it what it is, so if it's factual, but if you put it in the name, then it starts to get confusing.
But see, this was the cool trick about GNU, which is GNU has Unix in its name, but the name of GNU is GNU's not Unix.
Right.
So it's nominative use, because you're saying, we're specifically telling you, this thing called GNU, it's not Unix. Not Unix. Not Unix over here.
Well, that's actually, I would say, not even nominative use. That's not confusing at all. Plus, you don't usually say Unix when you say GNU. You don't actually use the term Unix. The U means Unix, but you don't usually see it spelled out.
It's spelled out a lot in the old days.
But
that was when it was the biggest worry, because that was when the Unix trademark was being most aggressively enforced. Mm-hmm. And that's weird that happens over time. This is kind of off topic, but over time, I've seen this in the computer industry a lot. Trademarks really lose their value over time, and people get less aggressive with them over time. Like the Unix trademark, no one is as aggressive as they used to be with the Unix trademark. I presume it's owned by somebody now. I don't know if that's true, really.
I think, as with anything, you can point to a lot of examples where through time people lose interest, or I could think of a lot of reasons why particular marks over time would not, you know, would lose their strength and power. But then if you and the interest of the owner to, or the person who has the trademark to enforce it. But then you look at like a Disney or a Microsoft, and you know that those companies have very strong interest in their marks and will go in and assert them.
Yeah, I suppose that's true, but a lot of older technologies people don't know. Nobody's asserting the COBOL trademark anymore, even though COBOL is widely used.
COBOL is widely used, but it's not really marketed that much anymore, right?
Yeah, it is.
To the communities
that use COBOL, there's all sorts of COBOL-related products.
But those are factual, right? Like
there's a lot of implementations of COBOL now and that sort of thing. And so I don't know what happened to the trademark. It might have been genericided. It might have never been trademarked.
So we keep talking about genericide, but we don't say what it is. Haven't said what it is. Yeah, genericide is basically this idea that if you use a mark and that mark becomes very popular and it is used for, it becomes synonymous with the kind of good that it was. And the classic example of this is Xerox. So people were using the term Xerox as a verb and as a noun just to say, oh, I'm going to make a copy. Instead, people would say, I'll Xerox that, even though it may not have been on a Xerox brand copier. And so basically the idea is that if your brand is no longer being used for something, for your particular product, and it no longer means your identity, then you lose some of your trademark. And it's really a protection. And it's very interesting, because it's this idea that it goes back to this, you know, will the customers be confused? And if customers in the public don't see any difference between, you know, a Xerox brand copier and a, say, HP copier, and they call it a Xerox, you know, oh, it's my HP Xerox machine, or you know, there are a lot of examples of this happening.
Kleenex, did that happen with Kleenex?
I don't remember. I think there was something about Kleenex. There was something about, you know, I know Coke actually hires people to go out, and that we're used to hire people to go out into the parts of the country where people refer to Coke generically. So people will say, I'll have a Coke, and they'll say, oh, would you like
root beer Coke?
Yeah, exactly. I've heard that before.
So, yeah, I want the root beer Coke, whatever.
And so Coke was actually hiring people to go into stores and say, you know, and to say, no, I want a Coca-Cola Coke. There's no other kind of Coke, to sort of protect their mark from becoming generic. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think the closest thing we have right now is sort of Google. Because my mother actually says, you know, I'm going to Google that. And she means search. So she'll say, I'll Google that in my email, even though she doesn't use Gmail. Or I'll Google it on Bing, or I'll Google it on Yahoo. It's this really interesting thing. So I think that's sort of the closest.
Well, I always say I'll net.search something because I don't want to give Google a monopoly on search anyway. So. Mm-hmm. But maybe I should just say Google to try to genericize.
They've got a lot of distinctive. I thought that was going to happen, but I'm not sure now. They also have expanded their business into other markets.
Right.
Now,
so they could be genericized in the search market, but not other markets. So that they don't have generic.
Well, but I actually think that because they're active in other markets, they're less likely to become generic
in the search market,
because Google has specific meaning as identifying with the company Google now for people who are not, who don't only know. Most people now know that Google is a big company that does a lot of things and not just search the way that we used to think of Google. So I don't know. It'd be interesting to see.
So for projects that want to avoid this, I think that pretty much any free software project may like the idea of being genericized. If there were like, for example, I can imagine if I don't think the Emacs developers would care if to Emacs something meant to edit something, and or the VI developers for that matter meant to VI something. It would be, of course, that's probably.
Oh my gosh, you've totally warmed up to VI.
Why?
Only because I noticed that when people who don't like VI refer to it as Vi, people who like VI call it VI.
I actually used a VI implementation called Vile on.
Oh, really?
VILE. It was on a DOS-based VI implementation I used in the early days before you can install GNU Linux on your computer. I used it.
You used to refer to it as Vi, I think.
Yeah, well, that's how I learned it, but everybody made fun of me for years. Years and years and years, people made fun of me. You don't know that?
No.
The people made fun of me for calling it Vi. That's what we called it in the first group I ever worked in 1991, and people thought it sounded
funny. We always called it VI, and I was really confused when people called it Vi. So I don't know.
Yeah.
At any rate.
It should really be Vi, because it's short for visual, right? So it should be Vi. It's like the question about bin and bind, because bin is for binaries, but most people say bin, which is not, they're not binaries. Does anybody in the world say the word binaries as binaries?
Bet there are places that they say that.
Binaries. Well, because /bin, I say /bin, even though it's /bin.
Trying to think of what part of the country it would sound like that.
I don't know. That sounds like something you would have outside the U.S., either somewhere in the United Kingdom or in Australia. Binaries.
With the I sounding like an E?
Yeah, well, because that's what you say /bin, you're saying binaries. There's binaries in /bin, right? There's not binaries in /bin.
Now you're making me think of places that make beans.
but before we finish up, what sort of general sort of policies do projects need? There's been a lot of discussion about what the right free software trademark policy is.
Yeah.
And there was fights over this issue in various different corners.
Sure. I mean, you know, I think it really depends on who holds the mark and for what purpose. So we're nonprofit lawyers here at SFLC, and our clients are generally nonprofit organizations and free software projects that are being developed in a nonprofit way. So from my perspective, almost always the answer tends to be, well, actually write your policy to make sure you permit all of the uses that you want to permit, which are extensive. Like, you actually do want to permit, people to be
third parties making t-shirts, for example.
Well, that's, it's interesting, actually. That's one of the few places where we see avid disagreement.
Oh, really?
I have amongst our clients that I've advised about their trademark policies, because some people really want people to be making t-shirts and other kinds of merchandise with their name on it. They're tickled pink. They think it's great. And I
others
agree
want
with that.
The revenue model that's based around t-shirt sales.
Yeah, or it just makes them nervous that, that people will think that they're selling t-shirts. So, the idea is whatever you do for your policy, you should make it subject to will the public be confused about will there be a likelihood of confusion about who is providing you the shirt? So if it implies any kind of official arrangement or relationship with the free software project that holds the mark, then the answer should probably be no. You can't use it, but you can basically, what I tend to recommend is sticking to the law and making the entire policy subject to so long as there's no likelihood of confusion. And there's a judgment aspect to it, but usually it's pretty clear, and it means that you're not trying to overassert your mark. If there's no likelihood of confusion, then who cares? Trademark's not meant to cover situations where someone's using your mark, but nobody's confused about where the source of goods is coming from.
It's weird to talk about goods.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. Trademark law, it comes out of commerce-related law. And so all of the actual terms that are used in the case law are about, they're all these businessy terms about branding. So it's very strange.
Well, yeah. The other thing I would ask is there a real difference between service marks and trademarks as far as how they operate at all?
I mean, service marks are on services, mm-hmm. And trademarks are usually on goods, but not really. There are some small differences, but not worth getting into here. There is a term I was just thinking that sounds very sexy, I was just thinking of before when we were talking about how boring and these terms are that are related to trademarks, and the term is naked licensing.
Which is a license you just get because they never gave you a license, or what?
So, no, naked licensing is basically, and this is actually what a lot of free software companies point to, is they point to this idea of naked licensing, and they say that that it's a real problem for them. The idea behind naked licensing is that trademark implies some level of quality control. So you basically expect, okay, if I get this product from you, it has your name on it, I know I can expect a certain kind of product, it has a certain quality, and I expect that. So the idea behind naked licensing is that if you give me that product, but you're not paying attention to what is inside it or what quality is. So say, just to get back to Coke, say I have I'm Coca-Cola, and I license a plant in Brooklyn in the snow to manufacture cans of Coke. But
they use snow
I don't,
to
exactly.
water?
And what, I don't what? Give them any recipe, and I don't pay attention to what kind of soft drink or drink they're putting in the cans, and they make something that tastes very similar to Fanta, and they put the Coke label on it. And I don't even know because I'm not paying attention, but I gave them a trademark license, and I haven't been monitoring the quality or what's inside it, then I could basically lose my trademark protection in that area.
This happens all the time, though, especially in the technology industry. I don't want to name any companies, but there are companies that are known for just licensing trademarks.
Yeah.
And putting them on electronics mm-hmm. products. I mean, you can go to Newegg and find tons of these.
Yeah. Now, the idea is that they're monitoring quality. They have certain standards
We all know that a lot of them aren't. I mean, just by the varying quality of the products and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, actually, you're actually talking about something different than I'm talking about, I think. I think you're talking, because I think I know what you're talking about.
No, actually, there's that example plus tons of others.
Because I think you're talking about the example where a company buys a product and then puts their own name on it, as opposed to what I'm talking about, which is
about they basically license the trademark, and people produce products, and, mm-hmm. and they're coming from their own factories, and they're just slapping the name, and because that name has some sort of value mm-hmm. to the
world.
Well,
they could be subject to naked licensing. So if mm-hmm. if the products are not there's no level of quality control, they could conceivably lose mm-hmm. some of their trademark protection. So there is this aspect to it, and for a lot of I think some of the free software trademark lawyers, so trademark lawyers for companies who are involved in our space, have made a lot of this and have said, well, we can't let you use our mark because if we do, we'll lose our trademark. We have to.
Right, and this has been an argument in the Java Test Suite issue right. and various other things, which, to their credit, Sun is, who knows what Oracle's going to do, but Sun had been a lot less aggressive than the mm-hmm. early days on the Java trademark, but there is this issue of you have to pass the Test Suite to call mm-hmm. it Java, and they've argued that has a yeah. trademark.
And basically, I think you can largely take care of this objection in trademark policies. So you can say.
Or you can name your project ClassPath.
If it's substantially unmodified, for example, mm-hmm. no problem in using the term. If it's modified, with bug fixes or whatever, then it's no problem.
Well, there's been arguments about that too.
If it's substantial, I know, but we're not. If it's substantially, if it's substantially modified, give people a way to refer to it. So say based on open free or remix of or something like that, and that actually I think solves a lot of that. Plus the idea of nominative use really overcomes a lot of these objections.
You can also just call it Ice Weasel too.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the thing that I was saying. That I was sort of hinting at the beginning of the program, which is at the end of the day, you can just if it's free software, the code itself is licensed under a free software copyright license. So you can take the copyrighted code and call it something, change any of the name conventions, and then you can distribute it as per the license.
Yeah, people were coming up to the Debian booth at Scale. I was talking to the Debian guys for a while, and there were multiple people who came up and asked about. About what was the deal with the browser and what is Ice Weasel?
Yep.
So I like Ice Weasel. Now that I'm a Debian user, I use Ice Weasel. Actually, I still use Conqueror, which is a Emacs like interface on top of ZwoleRunner, but occasionally I start Ice Weasel.
So, and I think just to end with a teaser, we might be talking more about this issue next time.
Well, then more on the side of what do you do if. It's the first thing that I was saying was the thing projects worry about, which is you have a name that somebody else. Mm-hmm. Is after or had before you.
Mm-hmm. So okay. I guess that's it for today.
Yep. IRC channel is pound SFLC. There are actually multiple listeners to this podcast who regularly chat on there. It's become, we've taken over, Pound SFLC I created as a really general channel for any questions. The thing is, the common question people, as they come ask a legal question, we tell them to email help@softwarefreedom.org, which is where you write if you want help. But now there's actually people just generally chatting from podcast listener land.
That's really great. That makes me want to hang out there.
Well, you won't. I tell you to.
Well, I'm always get very nervous about hanging out on IRC channels because people tend to ask me legal questions in that channel publicly.
Oh, you don't have to worry about that now, because now there's so many people in the channel that know that you need to write help@answer that before I get a chance to tell people, what you need to do is put this in an email to help@softwarefreedom.org.
I know, but I worry about the situation especially where there may be some ongoing dialogue.
Just say PM me and then you're good.
No, I know, but sometimes it's too late.
Nah. All right. That's fine.
Well.
Just tell them to private message you. Anyway, there's that.
You can donate to us at softwarefreedom.org.
Yeah, if you want to do that.
But then
there's some...
Don't interrupt me.
Sorry.
Somebody might want to donate to us.
But they can also email ogcast@softwarefreedom.org too.
Or podcast@softwarefreedom.org.
Yeah, but we're trying to say ogcast.
I know, but both work. I don't want people to think that they...
Yeah, it's true.
If they forget it's okay.
People are actually annoyed at me that I haven't made the change universal.
I think it's tough because I think when we say ogcast, people think that we're not releasing MP3s.
Maybe we should stop.
Yeah, I don't know. That's not.
The same. I've said this many times. Yeah. People ask that. It is not the same issue as.
I mean, it's something I think about. I'm sure you think about it too a lot. Yeah. And it's the idea of, you know, I want our show to be accessible to people who aren't familiar with the issues yet.
Well, and also I know that we have listeners in countries where there are no patents on MP3. So
right.
So why should I punish them because we have a dumbass patent system? Really?
Well, that's not a punishment to use OGG anyway.
That's true. It's not a punishment. So, but the point is, if they have an MP3
fine.
Player,
I just
free
think,
software.
I just think that there are a lot of people who don't even know that about these issues yet. And, you know, I'd like them to be able to find out about them by listening to our podcast. OGGcast. Our cast. We can call it a cast, apostrophe cast. It sounds a little sci-fi, but...
It sounds like what you get if you break your arm.
Not with an apostrophe before it.
But how do you pronounce
apostrophe?
You
just hesitate a little bit.
You just say GNU/Linux, like pronounce the punctuation. GNU/apostrophe cast. Okay.
All right. Well,
this is the end of our apostrophe cast.
We promise. See you next time.
Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. Is that copyrighted?
It sure is.
Copyrighted by Mike? Well, that's fine.
Oh, yeah, why don't we just record this?
I'm recording right now.
Oh.